Hi, I'm Kyla.
And I'm Jay.
And you are listening to Strange Fruit on WFPL.
We have a really exciting episode for you all this week. We are going to evaluate election results with U of L's Professor Sam Markison. We're going to talk to our new friend to the show, Will from Big Brother, about being a reality star and representations of queer folks in reality television. But first, let's get to the best part of the show, my favorite part of the show, Juicy Fruit.
First up is RuPaul's Drag Race. I have to like sing it every time.
I know you do.
Okay, yes.
So this week it was a really cool, well, I guess, episode.
Yes.
Who went home? Latrice Royale, Manila Luzon.
Yeah.
You know what? People who follow us on Twitter and Facebook know that you and I have been calling it accurately this entire season.
We have.
But
yes.
It was a really, really cute episode. They had to don their daytime, what you call your daytime face.
Yes.
So they had to go into the streets of California and, you know, entice passersby to do like stunts and tricks, and one guy there to spray whipped cream down his pants, and you know, it was really festive. And so for every task they got accomplished, they got points. And so it was about like who can be charismatic, who can do improv well.
Yeah.
And so
they really got to show their personalities with this.
They did. And so for the main stage challenge, they dressed up with like their bad girl looks, you know,
very, yeah,
like leather and lace, very kind of.
Because the lip sync for your life was Janet Jackson's
Nasty Girl.
Yes,
I love that song.
I do too.
And so, Doc, the final battle was between.
The lip sync for your life was between Manila and Jujubee.
Yeah, so on one side you have Manila and Latrice, and
yes,
on the other team you have Jujubee
and Raven, yeah,
who are our predictions for the final two. But
yeah, I definitely think that Raven and Jujubee will definitely be battling it out together. And, you know, our predictions is that Yara Sofia and Alexis Mateo will probably go home next. Definitely. That's our prediction. But I don't know.
Let me ask you this real fast, because Alexis hinted at the fact that they're always considered underdogs because English is their second language.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're all from Puerto Rico, from Nina Flowers to Yara to Alexis Mateo. And so English is not their first language. Alexis, of course, speaks it better than the other two, but do you think that sometimes, because I guess part of being a drag superstar is communication and, you know, and quite frankly, you know, regular old Americans sometimes just don't get people.
Yeah.
They don't get people who speak Spanish, quite frankly. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So do you think that that's a reason why some of the other queens, perhaps who are less talented, in my opinion, kind of count them as underdogs because they get tongue-tied, they don't always understand
definitely.
Concepts.
I think it's that, too, because I don't think that they have all this lack of understanding or that they have this lack of the language. I think that they're speaking it in the way in which it's still festive to them and still authentic to them.
You know, the shade is this.
Yeah.
You and I as Black people,
yeah,
I think similar to Rue, similar to the other Black contestants, they get it, right? So
yeah,
the same way that people say to Black folk, like, you speak that broken English, you speak that English, Black English vernacular, those Ebonics. I don't understand what you're saying, but we get it because we understand that you can communicate without speaking.
Yeah, and it's definitely a purposeful use of vernacular. I know when I use Black English vernacular, I'm using it purposefully, depending on what I'm speaking about, who I'm speaking to, and what the context of the situation is. And I definitely think that that's how Yara and, you know, Alexis become misunderstood. And I do think that they're underestimated. I do think that they probably will get sent home because, again, I don't feel like they have enough ownership over
themselves. They don't.
And
I think
and
part of
that
is because, and I think as much as they projected in terms of other people counting them out,
yeah,
to a large degree, they internalize that, which
yeah,
is what all the press folks do.
Yeah.
Whether we're Black folk, we, you know, think Black folks are too ghetto. You know, if we're gay folk, we think that, you know,
yeah,
gay folks need to play by the rules a little bit more to be accepted.
Yeah, so the self-policing,
you do,
definitely.
You do, and I think that they have kind of taken that on, and to some degree they don't perform as well as they could if they own that, were unapologetic, and were like, I'm fierce, I speak Spanish and English, what you
yeah,
got?
Yeah, I'm
you know?
Laid. Yeah, exactly.
What you got? You know, so.
Exactly. Okay, another thing that we are juiced about is Black Girls Rock.
Was very cute. Aired on BET.
Yes, and we're really, really juiced about it. It was a great, great showing of Black women, whether they were celebrities, everyday women, young women, women of a particular age, you know, grown.
Okay.
and showed basically all of these Black and female contributions to our different communities that we exist in and live in. And it was just paying homage to Black women's strength. And it was great. It was a great.
Because you cried. cried a few times because you're always like so. You're always so emotional. You get so emotional. But it was very moving.
I loved it. I loved every bit of it and every part about it. And so if you guys get a chance, it has already aired, but it's going to show over and over again.
Because you know how BET does,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, BET is going to show over and over.
My favorite part was when they honored Janelle Monáe. She really spoke to why she does what she does. A lot of folks don't know that she always wears the black and white. I'm always like, why is she always in this daggone black and white tuxedo? But apparently her mother was a janitor. Her stepfather was a postman. Her father was a trash man. And she spoke to the fact that these folks who wore uniforms, you know, went to work every day, worked really hard to put her in a certain position. And then she wears her uniform, which in this case is a tuxedo, to pay homage to those folks and to remind herself that she is here to do a job.
And that job
is to inspire, you know, other young women that there's nothing they can't achieve despite the fact their parents were janitors or post people or, you know, so I think that was really, really neat.
Oh, well, I love that. I didn't know that. Oh, yeah. Thanks for sharing that, because I didn't know that her aesthetic was very much in tune to, like, her genealogy
and
her historical, you know, tie to her family. Yeah. So, I mean, I just think it's great. So check it out when it re-airs sometime. Lastly, The Real Housewives of Atlanta premiered.
It was very interesting. Two cute new additions to the cast. I mean, cute in terms of, like, they're going to be spicy.
That's what I just wanted to talk about a little bit, because I kind of got upset about the way in which Kenya ends up getting introduced to the cast. Cynthia Bailey, who owns a modeling agency, is having a casting call for Jet
Beauty of the Week.
Beauty of the Week. And as you know, in the tradition of Jet Beauty in the Weeks, Jet Beauty in the Weeks are supposed to look like everyday black women. They're supposed to give a certain round-the-way girl type of feel. Yeah. And so Cynthia, who was a former supermodel and is still, you know, running her agency, asked Kenya, who's a former, you know, Miss USA, to help in the judging. And she is just coming for these women. I mean, she's saying that,
we can't say half the stuff.
I mean, she said,
Cynthia pointed out that this is not a model call in terms
of runway or couture or high fashion. Yeah.
This is for Jet Beauties of the Week. And the most important asset is that they have booty, right?
Yeah, basically.
So, you know, the face doesn't have to be, you know, they can be a little bit voluptuous, but Kenya's giving it to the girls. And
just basically coming for them. And I we've talked about this idea before on the show, the politics of respectability. At the same time, she's positing herself as some woman who is, like, you know, of a certain class and sophistication, and that she performs ladylike, you know, femininity, and that she's coming for these women saying that they were somehow uncouth or ghetto or too hood. You know, she's like,
the bathing suits didn't feel right. They didn't groom themselves.
And, yeah, she was basically saying,
you know, why did you come here? And,
you know, she, you know, was saying to them that they were not ladies somehow. And I'm thinking to myself, first of all, Miss Moore, first of all, these women were younger than you. And I felt as if you could have taken this as an opportunity to school them and nurture them. Definitely. But not to criticize them. As we, as women and young girls growing up, we are met with an onslaught of criticism, particularly physical criticism, in which we're doing body shaming, in which we're making young girls and women feel self-conscious about their bodies. And it happens to black girls, too. I know that a lot of black people feel as if, you know, black girls and women don't have eating disorders, but they're on the opposite end. We tend to be overweight, obese, and that's a form of disordered eating, okay? So we might not be bulimic and anorexic in those ways, but we definitely have body issues. And, you know, we've talked about this in reality TV, and we actually will visit this topic when we have
Dr. Will.
Yeah, his interview later when he talks about being over the top for reality TV.
One more thing I want to talk about, which you brought up last week, which I wasn't quite on board, which was VH1's Basketball Wives LA. Is that the one?
Yeah.
With Drea?
Yes.
And so, you know, you talk about, like, Drea, who's one of the basketball wives, and, you know, she's bisexual or lesbian with it or whatever, and I'm just like, whatever. I ain't buying it. But I did sit down and watch this week's episode, and Drea did a really good job of talking about LGBT issues in a way that felt very authentic, right?
Definitely.
So she takes her homegirl to a lesbian bar, and she's telling her homegirl's like, I've never been to a lesbian bar, but Drea's saying, like, I couldn't bring the other women because they'd be too uncomfortable or too on edge. I can bring you. And she's saying, like, look, you know, I find women attractive. I've been with women. You know, there's no shade. And it felt very authentic. Like, it's not like some video chick who dibbles and dabbles for the fun of it.
Yes, definitely.
You know, because it's cool. It felt like, oop, But she's on this TV show about very much about heterosexual relationships.
Definitely.
You know, and about, you know, what ball are you dating? And she really is bringing queer issues into light and doing it in a very respectable way.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a very good juxtaposition to what we talked about in terms of Blaine and Antoine, and the new Blaine and Antoine being Ms. Lawrence and Derrick J, and how you still have these very reductive images of black gay men. Meanwhile, a few channels over, you have some very positive examples of what it means to be a black queer woman.
Just like when it came to Jackie's wedding, one of the basketball wives, Jackie Christie, was getting married. Her and her husband do this thing where they get remarried every year for the past 17 years. They have a wedding every year. And she wanted to dedicate this year's wedding to the gay community. I'm going to say that one more time.
Well, I know you didn't
she
like
wanted
that.
To dedicate this year's wedding to the gay community. Now, her heart was in the right place. She wanted to say that everyone deserves the right to be married. But for Drea, she pointed out that she felt like, you know, as a bisexual person, it's a slap in the face. I can't get married if I fall in love with a woman, right? And you're going to have a wedding where you are getting legally married, where I'm at a gay club. So we can dance and prance around you. So, I mean, she really engaged that. She didn't attend the wedding. And then in this episode, she's actually taking one of the girls to the lesbian spot. So we're extra juiced this week.
Yeah, so, child, this week has been juicy.
Juicy,
you know?
Fruit, right.
And so we look forward to seeing what's juicy for next week.
Yes. To get an idea of how this week's election could affect LGBTQ folks, we spoke with Professor Sam Markison.
I'm Sam Markison. I teach at the University of Louisville's Brandeis School of Law, and the subjects that I specialize in are constitutional law and civil rights. Included under that umbrella are courses in sexuality in the law and LGBT rights. For a number of years now, I've been on the coordinating committee of the Fairness Campaign here in Louisville, and that's pretty much what I do and who I am.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. First, let's talk about Tammy Baldwin.
Truly, overall historic, and it's almost impossible to overstate what the overall results mean on so many levels. And in the case of Senator-elect Tammy Baldwin from Wisconsin, the first person openly elected as openly LGBT to the United States Senate. I think it's fair to infer and assume that we've had gay or lesbian senators before, but they've been in the closet if they've been there. This Tammy Baldwin has been out, totally open, and amazingly and encouragingly, never even an issue in the campaign up there. Her opponent, former Governor Tommy Thompson, never made that an issue. She didn't run on that as a big part of her campaign, her identity as a lesbian. It just faded into the background, which I think is important and historic as a part of the story up there in Wisconsin. And she won a decisive victory in a state that we know is the home of the vice presidential nominee of the Republican Party, a state that had a Republican governor, Scott Walker, who has been sort of at the epicenter of the anti-progressive movement in the last several years. And yet Tammy Baldwin, with an incredibly progressive platform and being openly lesbian, wins that race comfortably against a strong, long-term, well-identified, with great name recognition politician in Wisconsin. And to take that historic step is really pretty incredible and a landmark in American politics for LGBT rights and LGBT identity in our system.
Professor, I'd like for you to speak a bit about marriage equality. So several states this week had measures, ballot initiatives, ballot measures in regards to marriage equality. Maryland approved marriage by a margin of 52-48. It was on the ballot in Minnesota. Talk to me a bit about, you were on a panel a few weeks ago discussing, is the road to marriage equality via the courts, via voters? And the pros and cons maybe from both perspectives.
I think it's got to be both because they affect each other in very important ways. In the elections this week, you saw victories in four different states. In Maine and Maryland, voters approved law, and as well as in Washington State, approved same-sex marriage equality. And in Minnesota, for the first time ever, the voters in the state rejected a constitutional amendment that would bar recognition of same-sex marriage. And that sets the stage now, with Democrats having retaken control of both houses of the Minnesota legislature, and with a Democratic governor, for that state to have its legislature pass with now that there's no barrier in their constitution to pass marriage equality. And it seems to me there's a really good argument, I acknowledge, that you don't want civil rights being put to a vote. You don't want people's right to equality, equal treatment, equality under the law being put to the voters, majoritarian preference. But on the other hand, the fact of the matter is anyone's rights ultimately will only be protected if the majority is there willing to fight for them, to protect them. Because even if you win these battles in courts, even if the courts rule in our favor on issues like the Defense of Marriage Act, and even if we win on the Prop 8 case from California, the long-term protection of those rights has to be won because those courts stay willing to protect those rights. And courts will only do that if they're comfortable with where the majority is. And the courts are comfortable with where the majority is if we are winning those battles in the political system as well. So by winning these at the ballot box in a clean sweep in all of these measures, from Maine to Washington, from coast to coast, what that signals to the courts is that there's been a sea change, and these had been losing everywhere. And judges get that comfort level. And when judges get that comfort level, they're willing to go out on a limb because they think that limb won't break. And so I'm more than happy now to feel like if the Supreme Court does take those two big cases that are pending on its docket, the Defense of Marriage Act case from Massachusetts and the Prop 8 case from California, that Justice Kennedy, whom everyone thinks would be the swing vote, gets a bigger comfort level thinking that democracy has moved, the people's mood has shifted. And so you get a lot better chance of having your rights enforced when Democratic majorities support those rights. So I'm very comfortable with the effect that this will have in the legal arena as well.
So speaking of kind of public sentiment in regards to marriage equality, in many of these states, the opposition had a campaign that pitted Black and Latino voters against sort of the gay community. As someone who studies constitutional law, who studies civil rights legislation, talk a bit about the whole concept of, is gay the new black? Is this the new civil rights movement? Are they similar? Are they very different? Talk a bit about how both movements for racial equality and also for sexual equality, how they mirror one another, but also perhaps how they're different, both from a legal perspective and then maybe also from a social perspective.
Sure. From the legal perspective, the interesting thing to me is that the LGBT rights movement, not just when it comes to marriage, but when it comes to anti-discrimination laws, when it comes to gays and lesbians in the military, almost every civil rights issue that the LGBT movement has been working on for the last several decades, it gets accused of co-opting the racial civil rights movement or the women's movement. And the accusation is that it's not really a civil rights movement. It's about behavior and it's immoral. And there are certainly some African-American civil rights leaders who object to that language, even if they tend to support LGBT rights, some object to it. And what I've written about at times has been the irony of, I think, that accusation. Because, in fact, what you see is that it's the opponents of LGBT rights who are echoing the arguments of the opponents of civil rights from the 1950s and the 1960s. So it's only natural that the LGBT rights movement would respond with the same kind of arguments that were made by the civil rights movement. The opponents, for example, of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 used the exact same special rights rhetoric against African-American civil rights, saying that you were giving people special rights not to be discriminated against on the basis of their race, that the opponents of the LGBT rights movement have been seeing in the 1990s, 2000s, and now the 2010s. So if you're facing the same arguments against you, you're going to make the same arguments on your behalf. So what I tend to say to people is, if you're facing these arguments, if you have to make the same arguments. So it's really backwards, it seems to me. Now, as far as the marriage issue goes and the civil rights movement, there is no doubt that that there has been a disconnect in trying to be persuasive, to send a message that is effective to minority communities. And the LGBT community, I think, has done a better job, having learned the lessons of Proposition 8 in California, where there wasn't an effective outreach to the African American community, and there were those in the white LGBT community who tended to see it as a blame game, you know, and blaming the African-American community for that loss instead of trying to learn some lessons. How can we do better at sending a message about commonality and intersectionality? And it seems to me there was those who were seeing it in a more positive way said, what can we do better? And I think those lessons were learned in especially Maryland. Maryland, of all the states that voted on November 6th, had the highest percentage of African-American and Hispanics, and therefore it was the most important from a success point of view to do that kind of outreach to make sure that that message from the opponents on the marriage issue was not going to be successful. And you saw the results. It was successful.
Professor Markerson, can you also speak just briefly around this idea that of how important legislation and the passing of laws are for actualizing real basic rights for LGBT citizens?
Well, I think that it has a long-term component in terms of being able to get the kind of change by making sure that the people who have the power are willing to exercise the power on our behalf. Let's look at President Obama for a minute. He took enormous risks on behalf of LGBT civil rights in his first term, fighting for repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and winning that fight, refusing to argue for the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act, and coming under enormous criticism for that, coming out in favor of equality in marriage. All of those carried enormous political risks for him, for a community that some of the members of which were quite critical of President Obama for not, in their mind, moving fast enough. And they were very suspicious of President Obama at times. Some of the members of our community, the LGBT community, had supported Hillary Clinton during the 2008 primaries and never really warmed to President Obama. So he took some real risks. And this election, his reelection, showed that you can do that and still win the support of the American public, win re-election, and not pay the price at the box office. So if we can win these fights, legislative fights, political fights, and still win elections time after time, that will send a message to mayors, city councils, legislators. There's not such a big price to be paid. You can be the next Tammy Baldwin. You can be the next Barack Obama, whatever your office happens to be. And if that happens, that means we can get more legislation passed. That means we can get more civil rights legislation. We can get equality in marriage. And we can accomplish all sorts of other goals. It opens the door for the next victory as long as we keep winning and politicians realize it's actually safe. You can dip your toe in the water and you won't drown.
Let me ask you about the state of marriage in Kentucky, because in recent years we had a constitutional amendment that banned gay marriage in Kentucky. Do you know much about where we stand? Are there court challenges? Have folks kind of given up that fight? As other states move towards marriage equality, where do Kentuckians stand? What chances do we have towards ever reaching that goal?
Well, things are happening outside of Kentucky that will affect Kentuckians. If, for example, the Proposition 8 case goes to the Supreme Court, depending on how the court decides that case, it could have great impact. If the court decides there is a fundamental federal constitutional right to marriage, and that denying that right to same-sex couples infringes that right, then the state constitutional prohibition here on recognition of marriage would fall by the wayside.
Now, does that happen automatically? So say Prop 8 is overturned. Instantly, is ours also unconstitutional, or does it face a separate court challenge?
It would depend on the reasoning the court used. If the court used the same reasoning that the Court of Appeals in California used, then it would not affect Kentucky. I don't know if we want to get into the real technicalities of the constitutional reasoning, but the way that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decided that, they said, in brief, they said that only because California had once recognized same-sex marriage and the right was then taken away by Prop 8, that that's what violated the constitutional rights of same-sex couples in California. Since Kentucky has never first recognized it and then took it away, that reasoning wouldn't apply here. But the Supreme Court might decide it on different grounds. Supreme Court might say, we agree with the outcome, but it's because there's a fundamental right to marriage, period, whether it's first granted and taken away or not. And if they decided that, then it would apply in Kentucky, and it would mean that same-sex couples could start marrying in Kentucky if the court decided it that way. But there's no ongoing campaign right here in Kentucky right now to change or to fight against what's going on with the 2004 marriage amendment in Kentucky, to overturn that, to challenge it, to get the legislature to send it back to the people for a new initiative, et cetera. It would happen because something is going on outside of Kentucky that might have impact on the state of affairs here in Kentucky.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Markison, for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Professor.
My pleasure. Enjoyed it very much.
We also spoke to Will Heiser of Big Brother on being an out LGBT person on reality television.
Hi, my name is Will Heiser, Will with one L. I am 25 years old, born and raised in Louisville, Kentucky. I am a former recording artist turned online personality. I have thewillshow.com, which is I do comedy sketches, and I was also featured on American Idol and CBS's Big Brother.
So it seems to be pretty interesting how you came to be on Big Brother. So rumor has it that you didn't even know they were casting. You were kind of like at a club or at a bar chilling, and they said, hey, you know, we like your outfit, come audition. Tell us about how you ended up on Big Brother.
Yeah, I was actually in town for Derby, and a friend of mine, Holly Houston, was doing a fundraiser at Avalon, and the casting director was sitting there having dinner and walked over, tapped me on the shoulder, and said, would you be interested in trying out for Big Brother? I said, what's Big Brother? And then I was like, oh, yeah. And I was like, crap, that's still on. And I felt, I was like, oh, no.
It's my favorite show, Blasphemy.
Oh, my gosh. I know. Well, needless to say, I went in for an interview, and 2 weeks later, I had watched every season, like 700 hours worth of reality television, and really fell in love with the show and decided to go for it with them. So
tell us about the casting process. So you go in for your initial interview. Mm-hmm. Do they fly you somewhere? Do you have to?
Well, there's not too much I can say about it, but it's a really long
process.
Tedious. I mean, it was a 2 months of interviews, and they really do. They put you through the ringer, and a lot of isolation even before you get into the house, for sure.
Oh my goodness.
So, now you've mentioned being an actor, being a singer. I know that you have the Will Show. You've lived in New York. Mm-hmm. Your mother says in a quote that you always wanted to kind of be in the industry, the entertainment industry. Mm-hmm. Did you expect to be a reality star? Did you expect to be a pop star? What did you envision for your career? And are you satisfied with kind of how you've broken out?
Well, my career initially started as a recording artist when I was younger, from the age of 13 to 19. I was with 5 different record labels. I opened up for various different artists, Aaron Carter, a lot of teeny bopper related stuff. And that was my dream, was to be a recording artist and performer. And somewhere along that path, I got into sketch comedy and moved to New York and started studying with the Upright Citizens Brigade. And then I got into video production. And so my dreams have totally sort of changed. I think fame is a double-edged sword, and I wouldn't say I'm a fame chaser, but being an artist, trying to make money doing what you love is what I'm trying to do, I guess.
And on that note, I went to the CBS website, and what really intrigued me about you was that you don't seem to be a fame chaser or a fame whore. In fact, they ask you, like, what would you do once Big Brother made you famous? And a quote says, I wouldn't change much in my life. Fame comes and goes. Mm-hmm. You know, that you would just use the press maybe to help causes important to you.
Exactly.
What causes are important to you? What do you enjoy advocating for, and what, you know?
Well, one of my biggest things right now is our human rights laws here in Kentucky. Actually, the Kentucky Fairness Alliance, before I got cast on the show, asked me to perform sort of like a stand-up sketch comedy show benefiting the Kentucky Fairness. And I sat down with them. I was like, what is this going to go to? And they're like, well, we don't have basic human rights laws outside of Louisville, Covington, and Lexington. And I was like, what? Mm. Like, I didn't even know. And it's, if I don't know, there's so many other people that don't know. And I feel like if more people knew and were educated about these issues, the anti-bullying bill that keeps on being rejected twice now, I mean, I think it's all about education. If we can find a better way to inform people, we can get those things battled and solved.
And speaking of the Fairness campaign, you attended Fairness Over Louisville.
Uh-huh.
And so how did you find that? Did you have fun and,
Fairness Over Louisville was a great night. A lot of fun people. There's no better way to help out while drinking.
Yeah.
If there's a cocktail involved, I'm there.
I agree. I just had a question for you, Will. Mm-hmm. As an out and proud gay man, mm-hmm. On a show like Big Brother that seeks to take, personal information from contestants to play to insecurities and vulnerabilities, mm-hmm. I guess I'm curious how you mentally prepared for you know, being on the show, and then also how you had to keep that same type of strength mentally up in the game, right?
Well, I viewed going into the show a lot differently than my other castmates. You know, working in production, you know, my stint on American Idol, they basically made me the laughingstock of the city. So I was concerned as to how I was going to be edited, how I was going to be portrayed. Mm-hmm. And what an awesome opportunity to break stereotypes and sort of try to be a good role model for the LGBT community. And the issue with reality TV is, though, is you're at the mercy of a producer. Mm-hmm. And so I basically went into that house and just toned. For the first time in my life, I shut up and I just sort of listened to everybody else. And I was so, you know, I was worried sick every day how I was being, you know, edited mm-hmm. and interpreted. And in the end, I came across, from what I've seen, smart and not sort of like chassaying all over the place. And, you know, so but it was definitely really mentally, by the time I knew I was going home in the house, I was so happy.
You were ready
to walk. Yeah, I was ready. I mean, it was because I was, you know, I was stifling myself a lot. And I was, you know, I don't know if you saw my exit, but at the beginning of the show, I'm dressed in these dowdy sweatpants and stuff. And I dressed how I felt. I felt like this gray, dull person. And then when she said, you know, from a vote 6-2, Will, you've been evicted, I whipped out my hair and took off the clothes and had on my shorts and my captain's hat. And then I walked out. I wanted to show, you know, how happy I was and I'm myself again, you know.
Okay, yeah.
So
my question for you is someone who really is a big fan of the show and who, from my philosophy, if you get on the show, you get on there to win. Mm-hmm. Was it less important for you to win the show? Mm-hmm. And just more important for you to go on there, be yourself? If you're unhappy, I'm cool with going home. Or did you at one point want to win the show? Or was that really more about the experience than about winning?
I definitely wanted to win. But, you know, no amount of money is worth your personal integrity or your dignity. And, you know, reality television can make or break you. It can ruin your life or it can, you know, catapult you and open the doors for many things to come. And I basically just felt if I could hang on there long enough that it would open up enough doors, and, you know, being able to get to the end and win would have been wonderful. But, you know, I'm not going to be like Dan and, you know, who basically, you know, lied, cheated, and stole to get where he was. And, you know, he got a lot of negative backlash for that. And I, you know, it's not worth it.
Talk to me about your family, because I know we've kind of heard from your mother and your brother and your father. Mm-hmm. I think your father is a physician. Talk to us about family, what family means to you.
I come from a family of four. My dad's a general surgeon. My mom is his nurse. They own the Heiser Clinic, which is a fitness and nutrition wellness center. My brother, Chip, is 2 years older than me, and he is a world-class pole vaulter. And I think family, number one, is most important in my life. And I think, you know, I knew going into the Big Brother, you know, being isolated from everything for so long, I knew I was going to miss my family. But it really, having all that time to reflect and know how much they mean to you, you know, was definitely an experience I'm glad I got to have. I definitely appreciate, you know, family and friends a lot more, for sure.
Tell us about your favorite kind of experiences traveling, your favorite cities, your favorite things to do when you travel.
Well, I got the chance. I lived in Berlin for a little while, and I have to say that's probably one of my favorite cities. It's kind of like Washington, D.C. on crack. Really, the people are very cool and unique, and the music scene's really, you know, you go out to a club and they're playing ABBA and Whitney Houston, and then all of a sudden they'll be playing Garth Brooks, and, you know, it's super fun.
Mix,
and I definitely, that's probably my favorite city. But having lived so many places, and, you know, I've lived in L.A., I've lived in New York, I've traveled all over Europe, nothing compares to Louisville.
Are you serious?
I am dead serious. And I firmly believe it's not really our city, it's the people here. I think we're a rare breed. Mm. We have that, like, genuine Southern hospitality that I don't think you get a lot of places in the South. And I was actually doing an interview with WLKY, and they're doing a project on Kentuckians and reality television, because there's a lot of people that get casted from Kentucky, Louisville in particular. And they're like, why do you think that is? I was like, well, I think, you know, we get the best of both. We get that northern sensibility, we get the southern hospitality, and it put those two together, and we're definitely quirky and weird but genuine. So I think that's a lot to showcase on television.
Do you think portrayals of gay people on reality TV are either harmful, beneficial? What are your thoughts on
I think definitely both. I mean, I've certainly seen, especially on Big Brother, I think there's always like that stereotypical gay contestant. And in my casting, I'm not going to lie, I I was myself, but I amped up those things because, you know, know your role is what, you know, kind of what I like to say. So, but that being said, once I got in the house, I completely changed that approach. But yeah, I think in some ways it's helpful, but I think producers definitely like to stereotype and they have the power to edit it that way. So it's a sticky landscape.
So yeah, a little bit of both.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Will, a man of many talents. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. This has been so much fun.
What a wonderful episode. What an exciting week for many, many reasons. With this week's election, I remained optimistic the entire time. My friends were like, man, you are, you know, they felt like I was a little bit too naive, but I really, really felt like things were going to go well for us. And so I was very happy with the results of not just the presidential election, but also those states that were considering LGBT issues and Tammy Baldwin and other folk like her. I was really, really enthusiastic to see the outcome. And Dr. King once said that the arc of the Moore universe is long, but that it bends towards justice. And I do like to believe that the work that we're doing here on the show, the work that you do as a professor, the work I do as an activist, that it's for something.
I agree. I mean, this week's election was truly a historic victory for all of the LGBT candidates. And I think that for me, who's been working with this idea of women's liberation and LGBT liberation and Black liberation for years, for, you know, a lot of years now.
Yeah, because you're old, honey.
I'm grown.
you're a woman of a particular age.
I definitely am a woman of a particular age. But nonetheless, you know, I really saw this week's election as a nod to those who are trying to work on the side of justice, those who are trying to work on the side of what America really symbolizes, what it represents. It was, you know, to me, a nod for us to keep moving, to keep working, to keep organizing. That difference is becoming more and more...
the new normal.
I think so. So I'm excited. I'm excited and fired up. I guess juiced up.
We're juiced
and hyped.
The power of the people. As the saying goes, there ain't no power like the power of the people.
Exactly.
And the power of the people don't stop. All right?
Right.
Thank y'all for tuning in. We'll see you next time. All right?
See you next time. Strange Fruit is produced by 89.3 WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky. Our producer is Laura Ellis. The views we and our guests express on Strange Fruit don't reflect those of WFPL, Louisville Public Media, its staff, or its underwriters.
For more information on Strange Fruit, go to WFPL.org, find us on Facebook, and visit us on Twitter at Strange Fruit Pod. I'm Jason Gardner.
And I'm Kyla Story. Thanks for listening.